Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this edition of Inside Scoop Live. This is one of many features presented to you by Reader Views. I'm your host, Gail Campbell. Hello, and thank you for tuning in. Today I'm chatting with Paul Holton about his new book, Saving Babylon, The Heart of an Army Interrogator in Iraq. But before we dive into this amazing book, I'd like to tell you a little bit about him. Paul, also known to many as Chief Wiggles, has been married for 31 years to Keon, who is originally from South Korea. They have four children and one darling granddaughter. Paul has worked for FedEx for the past 16 years and currently is a worldwide account manager. He has taught at the University of Utah and Brigham Young University, teaching supply chain management, operation management, and internet marketing, among other topics. Paul has been in the Utah Army National Guard for the past 36 years and is currently a chief warrant officer. He is a Korean linguist and an interrogator and has been to South Korea over 50 times, with the military functioning as an interrogation team chief, interpreter, or debriefer of North Korean defectors. He was in the Middle East in 1991 during Desert Storm, where he interrogated many Iraqis. And more recently, he spent 14 months back in Iraq between February of 2003 and March of 2004 during Operation Iraqi Freedom. During that time, he founded Operation Give to provide toys, school supplies, medical supplies, and much more to children of Iraq and Afghanistan. And he continues to travel around the areas visiting children's hospitals, orphanages, schools, and poor neighborhoods, handing out much of those needed supplies. Operation Give continues to send items to Iraq and Afghanistan, where they are distributed to these children over several other countries. Over 40 semi-truck loads have been shipped to date so far. So that's amazing, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much. This is quite an honor.
Well, I'll tell you, the honor is really mine. And before we get too far into this, I just from my heart again, I want you to know how much I appreciate what you and everyone who has put themselves in harm's way to try to preserve our belief system, our way of living, a way of life, as well as to promote a way of life to people who haven't had that privilege yet.
Well, thank you so much. I never get tired of people thanking me and others for our service. So.
Well.
And I continue to thank everyone I run across to say thank you for the service and putting your life, like you say, putting your life in harm's way.
Well, that's right. That's right. This is a, you know, it doesn't matter how you feel about the war. There are always originally valid motives for a war. But somewhere along the line, I think sometimes those original valid motives might get lost. But I was particularly struck by the fact that when you came home from Iraq in 2004, you were startled by what you were reading in the American press about the war, about how it did not match your own personal experiences.
Exactly.
And in fact, this book, Saving Babylon, The Heart of an Army Interrogator, I think that is the essence of this book, isn't it?
Exactly. Uh-huh. I returned and I was, as you put it, you know, appalled and surprised by all the negative press, and I was compelled to put out the more positive side of things that I was involved with, in hopes that the message might get out there that there's more to the story than the American people are being told by the media.
Well, that's right. And how better for us to get that as Paul Harvey might say, the rest of the story, than directly from someone who's been right in the middle of it. And you were in the middle of it in a profound way. As an interrogator, you interviewed and interrogated. Interview is a kind way of putting it, isn't it? You interrogated, what, some 17 Iraqi generals?
That's correct. That was my initial responsibility, was to take care of the 17 generals that Iraqi generals that we had captured near the first part of the war. And so I spent about 5 months, day in and day out, night and day, with these gentlemen, getting information from them.
And you know, I mean, you know some of the atrocities that happened in the interrogation process, some at the hands of some of U.S. military personnel. But that was not your experience.
absolutely not.
Your experience was very different. And tell us a little bit more about your experience with these men.
Well, I think any interrogator would actually tell you that the best approach is to be nice. And actually to build a rapport and a relationship, build trust with the prisoner is the best way to get honest and truthful information. So in my 36 years as an interrogator, I have never witnessed any mistreatment of prisoners or detainees. And in fact, most of my friends were at the Abu Ghraib prison and were familiar with what happened that day as a result of the pictures and such, but were not
mm-hmm.
involved in it in
mm-hmm.
any way and have gone to Washington and testified as such.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we found the Iraqis, even the generals, to be very cooperative and supportive. There were exceptions, but for the most part, as we built a relationship with them, they divulged top secret information that was later used to capture bad guys and weapons and take out Fedayeen headquarters and so on and so forth. So
to prevent more harm that could have happened, huh?
Exactly. So I, over time, as these men, as we put it, vetted themselves and proved that they were going to be honest and supportive, I developed a very strong relationship with them and grew to respect them as they did me.
Now, Paul, I would expect that one of the first questions that might cross many minds is trust issues. How did you get them to trust you so early on, and how were you and your colleagues able to feel that you could trust the information that these people were sharing with you?
Well, right from the beginning, you know, we observed the generals and watched how they interacted with each other, observed their personalities and who was the leader of the group, and then we came up with what was our strategy, and our approach was to show respect them as generals, respect them as individuals and human beings. And actually they were surprised of how well we were treating them, because they had been told so many different stories of how they would be treated once captured. So initially they were taken back and surprised, and then over time, as they felt that we were sincere and honest and actually had their interests in heart, that they continued to share information and divulge secrets and such, that we proved, through acting upon the information, to prove that it was correct and honest information. So,
what, may I ask at this juncture, what motivated them to be willing to give that information up? Because at some level, didn't they believe in their heart of hearts that that this information was protecting something that they believed in?
No, and actually 90% of them, there were a couple of exceptions, but for the most part, they were not in favor of Saddam and his tactics, and his government were not supportive. Most of them had been in the military for some time as career soldiers and had actually entered the military prior to Saddam's taking over the government, many of them. They were older individuals, and so they... And many of these generals actually had surrendered once we came into town, so to speak. They drove towards us and surrendered their bases and their men and weapons and such, because they were supportive of our cause.
Ah, you know, I remember that. That's right.
Wanting to be free, wanting a new start with a new government, not supportive of Saddam's regime.
Now, you know, you've indicated that you had many great, even great discussions with these men.
Right.
You want to share a little of that with us?
Sure. Well, as time went on and as they continued to vet themselves and prove their worthiness, if you will, their support of our cause, we developed kind of a teacher-student-pupil relationship where they treated me as a the teacher, and they would gather around me at night as we would have open discussions with those that were supportive. Now, keep in mind, this went on over many months.
Right.
So at some point, after we had determined whether or not they were going to be cooperative, they began to be very open with us and interacted with us, and as I say, they would gather around me at night, and they even made furniture for me out of their tent pegs and poles
Wow.
So that I wouldn't have to sit in the sand, and I would sit kind of up off the sand as they gathered around me sitting in the sand, and we would interact and have open discussions about their families, their children, about their religion and their beliefs, and what they hope to do once freed, and what they would like to do with this newfound freedom that we were giving them. And so we had a lot of really just great discussions about my beliefs and theirs, comparing religions and then comparing lifestyles and hope and desires for the future.
Yeah, that had to have been a powerful experience for you. I mean, there you were. You were standing up against the corruption in Baghdad, and you were facing down Iraqi generals, and
right.
You were also seeing the children suffering, and all of that had to have stirred up just a whole basket full of emotions.
Wow. Well, I still feel them as you talk about it. It brings back memories and feelings. Just that I, over time, you know, I grew to love the Iraqi people.
I am so glad to hear that.
And they are so different from what you see on the news. And the news gives you a snapshot of the very worst of their society. And for the most part, these people are law-abiding, peaceful, loving, generous, hospitable people, as they invited me into their homes, and we shared food, and we had birthday parties together, and sang songs, and, you know, we just developed over time this incredible relationship and incredible love for each other, and they were so appreciative of our sacrifices and our the fact that we had left our homes and our families to go there to save them, as they put it.
Well, you know, so you're saying that many, many, many Iraqis feel that way, and yet, in most recent days, I guess especially since Saddam Hussein's execution, there seems to be such a resurgence of violence there.
Right. Well, we have to keep in mind who the players are here over there in Iraq, in that initially, you know, the borders were not secured, and we had freedom fighters, foreign fighters coming in from all of the surrounding countries.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in the south, the Iranians had overrun the south in many ways. There's so many people from foreign lands there to disrupt and to cause trouble and to ignite this sectarian violence that we're now seeing. This was initially started by Al-Qaeda, by Iran, by Syria, and every Iraqi knows it and would agree with me as I've spoken with them. There are the Saddam leftovers, there's
mm-hmm.
the Ba'ath Party people, there's the foreign fighters, there's the Sunni fanatics and the Shiite fanatics. I mean, there's a lot of players here. And it's their goal to continue to disrupt and kill indiscriminately.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it occurs to me from what you've just said that for the most part, much of Iraq has gotten caught between these malicious factions.
Oh, absolutely.
And that the actual population, God-loving, peace-loving people that are caught in the middle of somebody else's drama.
Right. And it's very unfortunate. And it's, you know, I speak with my contacts in Baghdad almost daily, and I get emails from them, and, you know, they're afraid. We've lost some interpreters that we worked with, and because of their efforts to support the United States, they have been killed.
Oh, my.
And so it doesn't take many deaths to put the fear of God in everybody so
right.
that they don't want to even come out of their homes. And the fact that these bombs are going off just randomly throughout the country, you know, people are afraid. And they're scared to death and afraid to say anything.
And, you know, as a matter of fact, even though much of your journey through Iraq and surrounding countries you've characterized as being basically a magical journey,
right.
You also came face to face with some of the nastier stuff, not only on their sides, but on our sides, didn't you?
I did. And you know, there are times in your life where you follow your heart and do what you think is right, regardless of the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one of those moments, one of those times in Iraq, as I one evening I was having dinner with the Iraqi Minister of Interior. I was working at the highest level of government there in that country, interacting with the governing council,
mm-hmm.
Ambassador Bremer's office, and so on and so forth. But
mm-hmm.
on this occasion, the Minister of Interior mentioned to me that the Baghdad Chief of Police was going to be promoted to a new position. And I had been investigating the Chief of Police for some time, in that so many civilians had come forward with information about his corruption. And so, hearing this, I wanted, my heart told me to do something to prevent him from being promoted, and so I wrote a letter to Ambassador Bremer and the Governing Council and my chain of command up through my general,
mm-hmm.
and the Chief of Police, having been put in power by the United States, by Bernie Kerik, him having friends in high places, that whole thing got spun around and turned on me, and I was put under house arrest and
By our government, by our military,
as they began an investigation of me, trying to find something against me, and basically all they could find on me was that I had been asking people to send me toys so that I could pass out to the children, and it was a difficult time for me because I was so threatened by what might happen to me.
Oh, sure.
That I was in fearing for my life, you know. And I was sitting there with the military JAG officers, the attorneys, and they were trying to figure out what they were going to do with me, and a runner came in asking, where is Chief Holton, which is me.
Mm-hmm.
And the President of the United States was looking for Chief Holton. He wanted to talk to me. And so, you know, of course, the investigating officers stopped everything, as they wanted to see what the president was trying to find out.
Mm-hmm.
The president wanted to talk about my efforts and applaud my efforts with the children in his prayer breakfast speech, which he did in 2004.
And this was in the program that you launched called Operation Give.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
in that, the president kind of interceded on my behalf, unbeknownst to him, that I was in a lot of trouble. It was a miracle, and it saved my life, and basically everything got put aside and the investigation stopped, and because the president was applauding my efforts to gather things and give to the children.
Good. Well, I'm glad. In fact, I wondered if he wouldn't be interested in this interview, so I'm glad to know. He's already very well aware of your presence. That's great. Well, you know, that had to have been a terrifying period of time. I mean, you have spent basically, it sounds like, most if not all of your adult life involved in military operations, especially through the National Guard, and as an interpreter, and interrogator,
right.
Both in Korea and in Iraq.
Right.
And
yeah, I mean, it was devastating. It was, you know, it was, you just can't believe it's happening. But yet I stuck to my guns, believed in what I had done, believed that I'd done the right thing, and prevented someone from being promoted further up into their government, a bad apple. And so, you know, good prevailed, and I was saved, so to speak, by the president. And
hey,
I mean, my whole journey through Iraq was just like that. It was just so incredible. Every day was a new adventure, and new miracles happening, and miraculous things occurring. As I all enabled the generals to be released at one point, and they came to Baghdad and looked me up, and we embraced. And we wanted to use them in the new Iraqi government, and so that's why those that had cooperated were released.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they took me to their homes, and I met their children, and, you know, it was just an incredible journey for me.
That is so wonderful to hear. And what happened with this guy who was targeting police chief position that was such a bad...
Well, he didn't get promoted.
He did not,
but the downside of this is that he was moved to another position and is now the ambassador to the UN for Iraq.
Uh-oh!
Yeah. Lives in New York City. And Tom Brokaw actually did a whole segment on his corruption, this guy.
Oh, wow.
They sent a news crew out to my home here and interviewed me for 2 or 3 hours.
Oh.
And kind of put out the word about how bad this guy is.
Yet here he is.
I don't know whatever came of it after that, but... I mean, I kind of feared for my life. You know, you just want to, because I was disruptive and blowing the whistle on him. You know, he had power and corruption. You know, again, you got to, you know, watch out. You have to be careful.
That's right, because that's part of the MO, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is to convince those who would like to believe that the intentions are honorable and that the greater number are really aligned in collaboration for a peaceful outcome, when yet that's not the case.
Right, and there is a great deal of corruption, and in fact, I ended up working more with the women, those, because I could trust them, than I did with the men. Many of the men were so corrupt and so used to corruption. It had been a way of life for them for 30, 40 years.
Right.
And a way of life in the Middle East. So,
it was just about the only way they could survive, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, they,
unfortunately.
Exactly. They were being rewarded for being evil.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Doing evil things. So that was the nature of their society.
Well, you know, I really want to applaud you. I've interviewed quite a number of authors more recently on more spiritually based subject matter, basically with the belief that, and especially with respect to this war and any war for that matter, with the belief that we don't always have to engage in war or stay engaged in war in order to cause a shift to more positive outcome. If we can just shift our own personal perspective on these things and,
right.
and come from a loving place in our hearts, we're inclined to experience better outcomes. And I think you have demonstrated that many, many, many fold here.
Well, and I appreciate that, and thank you very much. You know, sometimes it takes drastic measures initially to roust up the bad guys and provide freedom enough so people can make choices, and then through kindness and love win the peace, win their hearts and minds. We use that phrase a lot, but yet that's what I was doing.
Mm-hmm, it is.
Through giving love and giving kindness, and I couldn't communicate with them because I don't speak Arabic. Actually, I was using an interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
But so I had to, through giving, everybody understands giving,
right.
and receiving, and everyone understands love. So sometimes that's the only thing we have, and the best way to win the hearts and minds and win the peace that we are now engaged in this long struggle to win the peace and secure the country.
Right. Now, Paul, I want to go back to something, and that is there are some myths about interrogators, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely.
Would you share a couple of those myths and what the other side or the actual demyth really is about interrogators and interrogations?
You bet. And in fact, you know, through 91, when I was there as an interrogator, and throughout all my trips to Korea, and through this 14 months that I spent interrogating in Iraq this time,
mm-hmm.
again, I have never seen any mistreatment of prisoners. Never seen or even felt personally. I haven't seen any or felt the need to mistreat a prisoner.
So the myth here is that all interrogation and all interrogators use drastic dehumanizing methods.
Right, and that's so not the case.
That's not true.
I haven't personally been engaged in any of this, but you can imagine if the information is critical, and Americans are going to die if you don't get this piece of information, that you will push the edge of the envelope there.
Sure.
But I have never seen anyone engaged in any activity that was against what we agreed in the Geneva Convention.
Right.
But we go beyond and out of our way to take good care of the prisoners.
Great.
You know, you can't believe the way the prisoners are treated to ensure that they're fed properly and they're fed their food and that they're clothed and taken care of and treated if they're sick and any ailments or injuries or whatever. We went out of our way to try to get them in touch with their families so that their families were aware that they were captured, they were alive, they were okay, and everybody worked to that end.
Yeah, it was honoring and respecting many of their cultural beliefs and needs based on those beliefs, wasn't it?
Exactly.
As well as treating them with the kind of respect that every creature of God automatically deserves until they've proved otherwise.
Right, and it does require a certain amount of cultural competency, and many times we are, as Americans, incompetent culturally.
Oh, boy.
We don't really understand. We have a hard time of putting ourselves in their shoes and seeing it the way they see it, you know, understanding the traditions and the tribal mentality and everything that it's a complicated scenario that we're dealing with here. And so we need to make every effort to communicate both with our body language, verbally, with our the correct words, and with showing them the respect, unless, of course, as you put, that they don't deserve it or they don't haven't earned
they
that.
They breach
that
it
right.
in some way.
Yeah, if they're, exactly. There are those that will fight against us to that end, and then we use different psychological approaches. You know, it's not that hard to get into somebody's head.
No, it's really not, is it?
No.
Well, you know, Paul, we're not too far from being at the end of our time here, and there's one more thing, well, at least one more part of this whole process that I really want to have a chance to bring out here, and that is that you gained a better understanding of the system problems and what it might really take for us to be successful. Can you elaborate on that for a couple of minutes?
Yes, for sure. That's a great question because we're looking for solutions. You know, we want an exit strategy, we want to bring the soldiers home, but we've got to find a solution. And the solution is capitalism, if you will. Now, don't misunderstand me in that the Iraqis want jobs. They want an income. They want a future. They want education for their children.
They want to co-create their own lifestyle.
Exactly. And they need industries. They need skills. They need to somehow become part of the world economic order. And that through that kind of capitalism, this whole fighting, this struggling will stop. And I've had Iraqis tell me that. And there are many individuals that believe that to be the case, that our solution is to give them a future, and not just freedom, because you don't always know what to do with that.
Exactly.
You've got to help them feed their families and provide an income and get jobs. And that is the answer for Iraq.
And you know, if we look at our own society and cultures within our own society that are just asking for the same thing, we see that right here at home.
Oh yes.
That's my point. We see that right here at home.
Exactly. If we eliminate poverty, and we educate the uneducated, we eliminate a lot of crime.
And we can't just, I mean, there's no switch to turn off poverty. We can't just flip a switch and turn off poverty. But there are things we can do. I mean, I believe in helping people. I believe in that totally. However, my own personal belief is that the best help we can provide for anybody else is something that enables that person or family or group to better help themselves.
Right, exactly.
A job, job opportunities, better education, better health care, child care, the things that make it possible for people to get out there and begin to take some personal power over their own well-being.
Yes, and be, actually be in charge of their own destiny.
Right.
Because they have the capability, and we provide them with access to knowledge, technology, products and services, and let them play in that whole arena.
Exactly. And we're not talking about this in a scenario where people would, we're not talking about doing these things at someone else's expense. We're talking about creating win-win scenarios for everyone.
Right, exactly.
Well, Paul, we are just at the end of our time here, and I can't tell you what a profound piece of material this is that you've written. And again, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, and I know so many in the audience, everyone in the audience listening to this feels the same way, not only for putting yourself in harm's way, and our gratitude to your family for sharing you in that way.
Well, thank you very much.
And even beyond, way beyond that, the fact that you actually went into that environment and participated in creating positive experiences, positive outcome, positive operations. And your book is a compelling book. And tell the audience, you have a few websites, so if you would take a brief moment here to tell the audience where your websites are.
Yes, it's savingbabylon.com is where the book can be purchased. It is also at Amazon.com and other bookstores.
Great.
And also operationgive.org and chiefwiggles.com is website that I blogged on.
Great. And on that one, on any one or more of those, that they'll also be able to keep up with all the other things that you're involved in, right?
Exactly.
Great.
I want people to, you know, reach out to my book and other books that tell the positive side of things so that we gain hope that we're doing the right thing, that there is an outcome that we're gonna, that's positive for this. And there is. I firmly believe it.
Great. Well, and I want everyone to know that this interview is going to be posted to your author's page on Inside Scoop Live. And all your websites, all the ones you mentioned, as well as readerviews.com, will all have a link to this interview. So I want to encourage everyone out there to log on to the websites, read the reviews, read the interview, listen to this interview, and consider purchasing this book to help educate those around you.
Exactly. Spread the word forward.
That's
you
it.
You don't hear the soldiers coming home and bad-mouthing all of this.
No. No, you don't.
You don't hear it.
What a positive, positive story, Paul. Thank you so much again for joining me and sharing this with us.
Thank you.
And audience, thank you for tuning in to this segment of Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Gail Campbell. Until the next time, bye.